Welcome to the Corporate Counsel Business Journal's daily podcast, In-House Warrior, with host Richard Levick, chairman of Levick, a global crisis and litigation communications firm.
Good day and welcome to In-House Warrior, the daily podcast of Corporate Counsel Business Journal. I'm Richard Levick and with me today is Dr. Peter Sandman, who can only be described as an icon in the industry of risk communications, a longtime professor at Rutgers University who came out of retirement in January of 2020, looking at how COVID-19 was coming out of Wuhan. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. I know you and I were talking pre-show. I think I started reading your work when I was in graduate school. And the only thing I will say about that, that was in the last century, but I won't say which one. So, Peter, why don't you talk a little bit? Let's start with your background, because it's quite an extraordinary history.
I got into risk communication or helped maybe create risk communication in the 1980s. Earlier than that, I had been a specialist in what I then called environmental communication, and particularly interested in how do you scare people? You know, what do you do when a risk is huge, a public is apathetic, and you're trying to shake them by their collective lapels and say, this is dangerous, you know, take this seriously, do something, take precautions. That was my, essentially my field. And it was only in the late 70s and early 80s that I started to get interested in the other side. What do you do when a risk isn't huge? And people are freaking out, and you want to calm them down. And little by little, by the middle of the 80s, I had identified three different paradigms of risk communication. If you sort of picture a 2x2 chart, where one dimension is how dangerous is it, and the other dimension is how frightened are people or how upset are people. Sometimes they're frightened, sometimes they're angry. Then if it's very dangerous and they're not frightened enough, that's one kind of risk communication. I call that precaution advocacy, and that's where I started. If it's not very dangerous and they're terribly frightened, that's kind of, I call that outrage management, trying to reduce the emotional level that's inappropriate. That's the second paradigm. The third paradigm is, of course, if it's dangerous and they are appropriately very frightened, that's crisis communication. The fourth corner of that 2x2 matrix, where it's a trivial risk and people are not upset about it, I never found that to be a profit center. I never found a way to earn a living in that kind of risk communication. It's not, what would you say to people? Congratulations on your apathy. You're right. This is trivial. But in the other three corners, there's work to be done, but three different kinds of work. So I wound up with three fields and three toolkits, and trying to help my clients figure out not just how to do it, but which of the three they ought to be trying to do.
Well, I think that fourth quadrant, the trivial risk and the absence of concern and response, is probably called Buddhist, and I think that's our Zen, our Zen quadrant. Over the last 40, 50 years, you've seen variations of the theme of comfort with modest levels of risk. What is it that you think has led to this level now where there's such extraordinary and widespread anger and such absence of trust and anger that's leading to violence? And I think you would call this a moment, the outrage management quadrant.
I don't know the answer to that question. And there are too many hypotheses. There are too many possible answers to be able to tease them apart. It's pretty obvious that we are going through a moment. It's less obvious that this is a trend. I mean, it certainly, this is not the only time, even in my adult life and your adult life, when it looked like things were out of control. And, you know, I have at least the hope that this is a moment and not a trend, and that, you know, a year from now or 2 years from now, you know, the pattern will be different. And we, you know, you and your interviewees will not be talking about why is the level of public outrage so huge. I have a sense, Richard, that there's a kind of a law of conservation of outrage, that each individual, I mean, people vary in how likely they are to get upset, but, you know, within an individual, our disposition is calm or splenetic. It is what it is. And what varies is what we get outraged about. In some sense, I think what's going on right now, and it's gone on some other times in the past, is a very high percentage of our outrage is oriented toward public affairs, is oriented toward national and international events, some of it around the coronavirus, a pandemic, obviously, some of it around political developments. Those two are intersecting in complicated ways. I don't know how much of the political outrage would have, you know, how much less it would have been if we hadn't spent the last year in lockdown, you know, and very upset about the pandemic. So I don't quite know what's going on, but I feel like I know that, you know, people who would normally be outraged about things in their personal lives or things in their local communities are instead outraged at, you know, about a virus and a political standoff.
So let's, you know, over the years, you've done a lot of work with the vaccine autism scare. Here we are at a moment where we're seeing certain sectors of the population. We have the miracle of rapid development of vaccines for COVID-19, less of a miracle in terms of its distribution in this country, and then met with skepticism by different sectors of society. So how have you counseled clients over the years? How do you see this issue? And how would you counsel a Biden administration as well as the pharmaceutical companies who see the import of widespread use of the vaccine?
Well, it's very important to make a distinction between anti-vaxxers and people who are hesitant, either in general or with regard to a specific vaccine. I can remember quite a long time ago doing some training at CDC on vaccine risk communication. A lot of the people at CDC were very preoccupied with anti-vaxxers and were inclined to think anybody who doesn't adhere rigidly to the recommended CDC schedule of vaccination is an anti-vaxxer, is a horrible person, is all kinds of epithets. And I tried to address that, and little by little over the course of a couple of days, one after another CDC person would take me aside and say, well, you know, they're not giving their child all the recommended vaccines on the recommended schedule. They're spreading it out a little bit. There's a real difference between, being a diehard anti-vaxxer and being somewhat reluctant to follow all the vaccine recommendations. And that distinction, I think, is super important. It's never been more important than right now. If I had one piece of advice about vaccination to give to the incoming Biden administration, it would be worry much less about people who don't want to get the COVID-19 vaccine. You've got lots of people who are desperate to get vaccinated. Worry about meeting their need and worry about getting the vaccine out as quickly as possible. Worry about getting it out as equitably as you can, although I think quickly matters more than equitably right now in an emergency. But If somebody says, I'm not so sure I want to get it, say, fine, I hope you will change your mind. But in the meantime, the fact that you're willing to linger at the back of the line makes things easier for the people who want to get to the front of the line. And you get to stand aside and watch and see what happens and see how the early adopters fare. And if they fare well, you may change your mind. And if you don't change your mind, and when we're done vaccinating everybody who wants to be vaccinated, and we're mopping up, we will then consider, which is the worse of the of two evils: to coerce you, which is an evil, or to let you be permanently unvaccinated, which is a different evil. And we'll face that choice eventually, but we're nowhere near it yet. And by the time we get to it, you may not be in that group. You may have already decided to get vaccinated.
And do you find there is also this sort of the wisdom of crowds, if you will, that you focus on those people who very much want to be vaccinated, and that over time, people tend to go along, that outrage is easy on social media, but actually carrying through it in real life becomes more of a challenge?
Yeah, bandwagoning is a way more powerful communication tool than finger wagging. That's a principle that risk communication people and communication people in general have known for quite a long time. That telling people they're misbehaving and they should shape up is a very tough sell. Telling them that their neighbors are doing it differently and they might want to try to join their neighbors, or they might want to think about whether they want to join their neighbors, is a much stronger appeal. I got my first dose a couple of days ago, and I was very surprised that they didn't give me a pin. They didn't give me a button. They didn't give me an armband. They gave me nothing that I could sort of, wear or put on my doorpost or something to signal that, I got vaccinated, and when you can, you should too. Because that's the kind of bandwagon that we should be encouraging. And I would pay much more attention to the people who want to get vaccinated and much less attention to the people who don't yet. And above all, don't corner them. Don't define them as permanently unwilling to get vaccinated. Leave the door as open as you can so that they can change their mind without humiliation.
There's a likelihood after January 20th that campaign, there may be actually a campaign similar to the I voted stickers that we all get for exercising our civic duty. What recommendations are you giving to companies, when they reopen, in terms of policies or how they communicate vaccine use?
It almost goes without saying that companies ought to be supportive of their employees getting vaccinated, and that support should include advocating for their employees being able to get vaccinated, and insofar as it becomes possible, facilitating that. We know that people are way likelier to get the flu vaccine if the workplace has a station and people get told you can just walk on down to the seventh floor and get vaccinated during your work time. Anything companies can do to facilitate vaccination, they should certainly do. The tougher call is whether they should require vaccination. Assuming they're legally permitted to, and I don't want to give legal advice to an audience of lawyers, but my understanding is they are legally permitted to in most cases, that the workplace can require vaccination. That's going to be the tough decision. I would like to see employers share the dilemma about that decision. I would like to see them communicating with their employees that they are trying to decide whether to require vaccination or not, They really want everyone vaccinated, but they hate the idea of coercing the minority that don't want to be vaccinated. They hate even worse the idea of having to fire people because they don't want to be vaccinated. On the other hand, how horrible it would be if the unvaccinated people, create a cluster in our workplace and we have to shut down again. Sharing that dilemma is, I think, useful on the way toward actually publicly within the company, making a decision. There might be intermediate positions. I can imagine in some workplaces you might be able to say the unvaccinated people work over in that corner where they're interacting only with each other and not with the vaccinated people. I think that's going to be the tough call. Before we get there, the easy calls are advocating for your employees to get vaccinated and making it as easy as you can.
You're absolutely right in terms of the easier area. And I can imagine a few months down the road here, issues of tortious liability for allowing people to, in large numbers, who are unvaccinated to potentially infect those that have been vaccinated. HR concerns if they're separated and therefore perceive it as a hostile work environment. Insurance pressure insurance companies who feel that companies haven't done enough to minimize risk. So you're right. Your approach makes perfect sense and will work for a while. It will get challenging in time.
Yes. And I guess what seems important to me right now is not to get there early, to focus on the low-hanging fruit. And the low-hanging fruit is people who want to be vaccinated, and anything the company can do to help them is a win-win.
What do you think the impact, I think all of us were shocked that masks became a political symbol. And do you think that masks have in part been one of the issues that have led to vaccine reluctance?
Yeah, well, I mean, we politicized pretty much everything in this pandemic. And that was a surprise. Some of the blame obviously attaches to Trump, but a good deal of the blame, I think, attaches to the left. Two central moments with regard to masking that were not at all Donald Trump's fault. One was the decision of public health
football
to tell the public early on that masks weren't useful when that was not what they believed. They believed that masks are useful, but there's a shortage. And we don't want to tell people, yeah, it's useful, but we need it more than you, so we don't want you to use it, because that they thought that wouldn't sell. So what they said instead is, ordinary people have no use for masks, and they very quickly knew better. And if they weren't lying, they were at least misstating their beliefs. So when public health switched it switched on a dime from don't use masks, you're a horrible person if you use a mask, to you're a horrible person if you don't. There was a considerable and I think justified loss in trust. The second moment where there was a loss in trust was when public health decided that anti-racism demonstrations could not possibly be super spreader events because they're so virtuous. The whole tendency of public health to get, I can remember a period in which, any demonstration outdoors or not, that was against lockdowns was described by public health professionals as horribly dangerous because these people are gathered together. And yet when people gathered together in the wake of the George Floyd killing, public health took a very different position. Those were two ways in which the left politicized masks. The ways in which the right politicized masks are perfectly obvious. So, yeah, I mean, everything about the pandemic became a signal of identity. And I am hopeful that vaccination will not go the same way. I mean, there's a great risk that vaccination will go the same way, you know, in part because, you know, and you know, I think you know this history, that you know, because the Trump administration was pushing speed on vaccination, a large number of Democrats started pushing hesitation about vaccination. And, you know, although generally Democrats are way more pro-vax than Republicans, there was a period of a couple of months in which Democrats were as reluctant to get the COVID-19 vaccine as Republicans were. And that, you know, I mean, for Democrats to get down where Republicans were in their reluctance to get vaccinated was a very major political shift. I'm glad to say it shifted largely back. Both Republicans and Democrats are less hesitant than they were a couple of months ago. And the Democrats have moved up more. I don't know what would have happened if Trump had won the election on that dimension, but I mean, that's a hypothetical we don't have to worry about.
So two issues there. One is, you know, I've always found it fascinating in my 40-plus year career in crisis communications, as I'm sure you have, that Mother Nature in the future have a way of outsmarting us, no matter how Machiavellian we think we are in trying to change the rules to fit the moment. As you say, you know, public health officials looking at virtuous Black Lives Matter protest and thinking, well, we'll apply different science here than we might at other times. And the list goes on and on, and forgive me for only choosing one example. And the other is that we tend to give extraordinary authority to the Polaroids of polling, which are giving us nothing but a moment in time. And when the initial numbers came out about opposition to vaccine, we gave it a weight, as if it had, as we do so often, as if it had some level of permanency, rather than just give it some time. And we've seen the numbers that you're talking about amongst all groups of Americans, whites, people of color, Republicans, Democrats, shift in different numbers, but nonetheless all shift towards increased acceptance of vaccination.
Yeah, I agree with both of your points, and particularly the first. I mean, you know, up until the current moment, everybody kind of understood, including everybody in public health, kind of understood that, you know, if you have a pandemic of a novel infectious disease that's, you know, pretty contagious and pretty deadly, you've got a worldwide catastrophe and you just have to live through it. And there are ways of mitigating it to some extent, but nobody until now thought that you could get through a pandemic, you know, without horrible outcomes. So I have some sense as I look at you know, Sweden tried one way and it didn't work, and Europe tried it, you know, at large tried a different way and it didn't work, and the U.S. tried a different way and it didn't work. And, you know, I mean, the question of what does it take to, you know, short of a vaccine, until you have a vaccine, what does it take for this not to be a disaster for your country? It seems like, you know, there are three ways you can avoid a disaster. One is to be a really small island, you know, that's isolated and that can close its borders. And, you know, that's the New Zealand solution. The second is to be extremely authoritarian and be able to order your citizens around and they'll take orders. And the third is to be a very communitarian country where people are accustomed to taking care of and caring about the welfare of strangers. And China did very well because it is both authoritarian and communitarian. The United States and most Western countries, I think, predictably did horribly because we're not communitarian and we're not authoritarian. We're individualistic. And, you know, I think it was sort of baked in from the beginning that an individualistic country is going to have a horrible time coping with COVID-19 until we get a vaccine. And I, you know, if we'd had a President Clinton instead of a President Trump, I think it would have been horrible, maybe less horrible, but horrible enough that we would have all agreed it's horrible.
Yeah, and you know, one other example, you identified three different approaches, but would you argue, where would you put Korea? You know, you've got a population of just under 60 million, you have just over 500 fatalities. If you multiply that towards the percentage in terms of the population of the United States, you know, if we used Korea's approach, then we're at 3,000, 3,500, 4,000 fatalities, not over 350,000.
It's all three. Or at least it's two of the three. It is an island in the sense that North Korea, its only land boundary is with North Korea. So it could close itself off very easily. And it's a communitarian culture. It's a culture in which, both religious traditions and secular traditions are very community oriented, much less individualistic than our culture. The extent to which South Korea is authoritarian, I can't say it's all three, but it's at least two of the three, and we're zero of the three.
As we move forward, what recommendations are you giving to companies, particularly now when there's both hope and light at the end of the tunnel, but also the realization that we have a dark winter still in front of us?
Well, I mean, I think you just said the most important message. You know, we can see the light at the end of the tunnel, but we're in the tunnel, and we're going to be in the tunnel for a few more months. And which of those you emphasize, I think, depends on which of those people are missing. You know, I mean, there was a period of time in which people didn't realize there was a light at the end of the tunnel. Now we're at a time when people are overreacting to the light and underreacting to the tunnel. So I think, you know, the core message right now has to be less about vaccination and more about, you know, boring though it is, masks and social distancing and hygiene and staying outdoors and all the things that we've been hearing for lo these many months. And I would link that to vaccination. It's not, you know, take those precautions even though there's a vaccine on its way, but it's take those precautions, especially because there's a vaccine on its way. There's a normal human irrational tendency to respond to the light at the end of the tunnel by pretending you're not in the tunnel anymore. And that is natural, and you know, we should normalize it. We should kind of laugh at it gently in our messaging. But we really need to remind people that they do not want to get sick a month before they could have gotten vaccinated. You know, that now more than ever is the time to take precautions because we're almost there. And the last thing you want to do is be the final casualty of this long war.
You know, I keep thinking, and it's so interesting that you would use the war metaphor. I keep thinking back to World War I, when the war would officially end on the 11th, at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. And how many fatalities occurred in those final hours because of some lack of preparation or a little of displacing perhaps some of the prophylactic concern that soldiers otherwise did because we were hours away, days and hours away from a cessation of the hostilities.
Yeah, it is natural, as I said. I mean, it's totally analogous to the fact that, you know, every time officials say effective Tuesday, we're going to close all the bars, everyone goes out drinking, or at least millions of people go out drinking Monday night because the bars are closing tomorrow. And, you know, the rational response is the bars are closing tomorrow because it's really dangerous. So the last thing you want to do is go out drinking tonight. But I mean, that's stupid, but it's human. And you know, good messaging says both of those. I mean, if you only say it's stupid, people are going to reject the message. You know, so you need to laugh at it gently, and you know, it's like, you know, how foolish we human beings are, rather than you idiot.
In-House Warrior is sponsored by Corporate Counsel Business Journal, the leading resource for corporate legal executives for over 25 years. Go to ccbjournal.com to receive your free issue today and to listen to more episodes of In-House Warrior. As we close this interview, let's change the subject gently if we can. Corporations are being thrust into the limelight, the 70-year, 75-year approach of the middle path, not trying to be political, is increasingly, if not already, impossible. Many companies are pulling back on funding, contributing to politicians, particularly to what's known as the 147, and the attorneys generals who enabled the 16 Republican attorneys generals who have been enabling the false narrative of the, quote, stolen election, which led to the unsettling protest, violent protest, and insurrection at the nation's capital. What are you recommending to companies as they look forward in terms of their internal communication, their external communications? How are you helping them and recommending? What are you recommending to them?
Let me tell you what I have recommended over decades. And let me preface that by saying it may be that that's not the right recommendation anymore. And I'm kind of glad I'm mostly retired because I don't have to rethink it, or at least I don't have to rethink it on behalf of clients. But for 30 to 40 years, I have been saying to clients that, they have a fiduciary obligation to their shareholders, to maximize long-term sustainable profitability, that fiduciary obligation entails, as a corollary, an obligation to pay attention to the wishes of stakeholders, because if stakeholders get pissed off at you, shareholders lose value. What I would say to clients is corporate social responsibility is a crock, but if you change it to corporate social responsiveness, you know, same initials, you don't have to re-embroider the towels, that is a much more sustainable value and much more compatible with what we want. Again, this is what I have historically said to clients. Most of your stakeholders do not want your corporation to have a foreign policy. They don't want your corporation to have a political ideology. They want your corporation to be responsive to them and to all the various thems. But it's about responsiveness, not responsibility. Responsibility is doing what you think is good for the world. Responsiveness is doing what your stakeholders think is good for the world. And responsiveness is the right posture. That's what I said for decades. And I allowed as how once in a great while, there is an exception, that an issue arises that is so fundamental that you need to have a value as a corporation that is not merely responsive, but that is in fact a core value of your company. And the example I gave was Nazi Germany, that, it, you know, if you were a German company, when the Nazis asked you to build concentration camps or to supply them with the gas for the gas chambers, you should say no, even if your stakeholders and your shareholders thought you ought to say yes. And I said that, you know, if that happens once in your life, it's a surprise. If that happens every couple of weeks, you're misjudging the situation. All of that was my traditional, you know, sort of shtick, you know, or more than shtick. That was what I believed was the right way for corporations to address this question. So either we are now in a situation analogous to Nazi Germany, and I don't think we are, or I was wrong, which is a real possibility, or corporations are making a mistake when they respond to this sort of momentary excess of value centricity and decide that they need to identify with the sort of, use a single word, the anti-Trump side in the battle that's dividing our country. And I don't know which, you know, maybe I've been wrong for 40 years. Maybe this is the singular moment like the gas chambers. Maybe corporations are making a mistake. One of those three is true.
We have the word that so many people find is being overused at this moment and yet necessary is unprecedented. So whether or not we are at that moment, we are certainly in unprecedented territory. And it is requiring new challenges and new thinking for companies, for governments, for the military, for so many leaders, and for all of us. Dr. Peter Sandman, thank you so much for joining us today. It is always a great pleasure, and I want to thank you for joining the program.
Thank you. My pleasure.
This is Richard Levick with In-House Warrior, the daily podcast of the Corporate Counsel Business Journal. Thanks so much for joining us today. I've been speaking with Dr. Peter Sandman, an extraordinary icon in the industry for half a century. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Corporate Counsel Business Journal's daily podcast, In-House Warrior, with host Richard Levick. If you've enjoyed listening to our show, please rate and subscribe to the In-House Warrior on your favorite podcast platform.